Hi, I'm J. Christian Adams, president of the Public Interest Legal Foundation. This is the Protecting Your Vote podcast. Thanks for joining us. Today, we have a very special guest, Hans von Spakovsky, who is not only the chairman of the board of the Public Interest Legal Foundation, but also a senior legal fellow and manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, that is a mouthful.
It is. And this podcast, this is your revenge on me, right? Because I just had you on my podcast called Case in Point to talk about this new case you guys have filed in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, the voter intimidation case where Trump voters got death threats.
Right.
Well, we'll have lots more to talk about on that shortly because there's developments in that. It's fairly fast moving. But today we wanted to talk about a number of things. One is we're going to talk about the Heritage Voter Fraud Database. Because after all, voter fraud doesn't exist. So no sense in wasting much time on that one,
right,
according to the Academy. Also, we also have some fascinating things. We both recently were on the Election Assistance Commission Board of Advisors meeting. Let's touch on that briefly, too. What else should we talk about?
Well, you know, there's big news. It sounds like something out of a Hollywood screenwriter's plot. You know, Kash Patel has just turned over information to the U.S. Senate about an apparent plot by the Chinese Communist government to submit lots of fake absentee ballots in the 2020 election.
So as I understand this somewhat fast-moving story,
right,
not only were there indications that the Chinese were attempting to exploit mail balloting in 2020, but they were actually, in the United States, there were driver's license appearing in bulk. There were caught by customs, as I see it, with all these names of right, fake driver's license.
Right. The idea was that they were creating fake state driver's licenses, and then they were going to ship them into the United States so that individuals, Chinese nationals, Chinese students, who of course are not U.S. citizens and aren't supposed to vote, were going to use those fake IDs to submit absentee ballots. And this first surfaced as a report from the FBI in the summer of 2020. The odd thing about all this is that the FBI sends out a report to its offices, other federal law enforcement agencies, and then like 2 weeks later says, oh, we're withdrawing the report and we want everybody to destroy all copies. Now, they said they were basing this on a confidential informant, but it turns out that at almost the same time, Customs, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, actually found 20,000 fake driver's licenses. They were able to find these, which apparently they were able to determine were coming from Hong Kong and China and were being shipped to battlefield states.
Well, okay, so reset this. This is 2020 during COVID. The Public Interest Legal Foundation was involved in a number of lawsuits trying to make sure that mail balloting didn't mean more voter fraud.
Right.
And everything was being shoved to the mail. And so we lost that safeguard of having in-precinct voting,
right,
where you could check IDs and so forth. But I got to tell you, Hans, back in 2020 and before that, Logan Churchwell is a research director here at PILF. He had been warning about vulnerabilities that the Chinese and other foreign governments could take advantage of regarding dirty voter rolls.
Right.
And if somebody is, not dead or dead, and if they're on the rolls, the state of the voter rolls is creating a vulnerability in the country. And so we kind of saw this coming, and we actually did see it happening at the time in 2020, but then the story just disappeared. It was one of the strangest things. Like the driver's licenses, I think it was at O'Hare, is where those were caught. And then it was there one day, and then the story vanished.
Yeah, but that apparently was deliberate because, you know, the only reason we know about this now is because Kash Patel, the head of the FBI, apparently found this. When he got over to the FBI, he sent it over, I think, to Senator Grassley and the U.S. Senate. And we now, you know, in addition to the FBI report and the way the FBI tried to make the report disappear, now a whistleblower has come out. A whistleblower, I think his name is Christopher Porter. He he was actually at part of the whole intelligence system for several years. And he says that he was there when this report came out. He started looking into it, and he was told, we're not going to investigate this. And when he kept pushing that obviously this needs to be investigated, he says he was fired.
Yeah. Well, this is a shame, because I like to talk about what would America have done 30 or 40 years ago. Everybody would be in favor of getting to the bottom of this. And something has changed, and let's put the blame where some of it belongs, and that's with the media and academia. Because whenever there's a story like this, mail ballot problems, lack of security, vote impersonation, what do the media and academia always do as an initial matter?
Say, oh, there's no fraud. We don't need to worry about it. And of course, to disprove that, all people need to do is go to the Heritage website and check out our election fraud database.
What a segue to our second topic. So what you're referring to, and this goes back, I want to say 7 or 8 years, perhaps.
That's right. Yeah.
And about 7 or 8 years ago, I think you and I and some others just got sick and tired of hearing there's no such thing as election fraud.
Right.
And we looked around and we realized, you know what? No one's cataloging this.
Yeah.
It's all hit and miss stories.
Right. And I got to give credit to my boss in the legal center, John Malcolm, who's a good friend of both of ours. He said, well, we need to put together a database of proven cases. So what we've done now for many years is we maintain this database. We're about to update it. We're going to go over 1,600 proven cases of fraud. And folks need to understand, we don't put any he said, she said stories in there. We only put in a case if somebody's been convicted in a court of law of engaging in election fraud, or a judge has ordered a new election because of fraud, or there's been an official finding by a government agency, as happened, for example, as you know, in North Carolina back right in 2008, when the State Board of Elections overturned a congressional race because of what they called massive widespread absentee ballot.
Right. And John Malcolm, who you just mentioned, I need to tell him this, or you could take the message back to him. The Public Interest Legal Foundation on multiple occasions has taken the Heritage Fraud Database, turned it into an amicus brief, and filed it in court cases. Like, look, here is voter fraud. And so we've used it to get this data in front of courts.
Yeah, and I can tell you that state attorney generals have used it also. Whenever states have actually passed good reforms, like voter ID requirements, and the other side comes and says, oh, this isn't needed, no fraud, it never happens. We've had state AGs also submit information from that database. And the thing is, you know, some of the cases are people, a group of people actually trying to overturn an election. Other cases are what everybody likes to call lone wolves. You know, somebody taking advantage of the system, somebody who says, oh, you know, I can easily register in two different states and vote and cast two ballots for the candidate that I want to support.
So you might not know this, and I don't think we had a chance to talk about this yet. Some of our clerks are doing research on state Voting Rights Act laws and whether they overly racialize elections. And they stumbled on a provision that made me think of you. And we just haven't a chance to talk about it.
Really?
There are parts of some state Voting Rights Act laws that prohibit local legislative bodies like school boards or county councils from using data about voter fraud in other jurisdictions to pass a law in that jurisdiction. In other words, you can't just look at the Heritage database to decide you need to have a prophylactic law in your jurisdiction. They prohibit that being a legitimate interest.
And that is just absurd. But it's not just absurd, but that's dangerous. I mean, honest elections are so important. And we should mention, since we brought up the Heritage database, we need to mention the Public Interest Legal Foundation's database on tied elections. Because, you know, oftentimes I'll have folks who criticize the database say, well, okay, even if it happens, the margins of victory are so big, it doesn't really matter. But you guys put together a database that The last time I looked at it, there were literally hundreds of elections in there that have been decided either in a tie vote or by one or two votes, right?
You're right. It's the Public Interest Legal Foundation Tied Elections Database, which is in some ways a counterpart to the Heritage Voter Fraud Database. And that is all these elections around the country that were ties. And they're usually resolved by games of chance.
Yeah.
In Virginia, control of the Virginia House was decided by pulling balls out of like a fish tank or a globe. In other words, one single race for Virginia House, which is down there in Norfolk or Newport News, was decided by a random game of chance, and it swung the entire control of the Virginia House.
Right, and we should mention that, was it just last year, Virginia announced that it had taken in the last, what, decade, something like over 10,000 aliens off the voter rolls.
Yeah, well, and the voter fraud in a lot of these places, all it takes is one vote to change an outcome.
That's right.
And when you have hundreds of elections around the country being resolved by a game of chance, it should silence all of these folks. One of the favorite arguments that I see used in the media against the Heritage Database is, oh, what, they found 1,600 cases out of a billion votes. How lazy is that statistical analysis? Especially if, let's say, you're in the Virginia House, right?
Yeah.
One vote mattered. One vote swung the entire control of a legislature.
Yeah, and look, you and I both know, from because we've worked on this so long, that look, there are town council races in every state around the country where there may only have been a couple of hundred votes cast. It doesn't take many votes to overturn the election. I keep thinking about one of the cases we put in Compton, California. I'm sure people have heard of Compton because there was a movie, right, straight out of Compton made about that. Well, just like 2 or 3 years ago, Compton went into our database because there was a city council race there decided by one vote. And what did a court find? The court found that half a dozen individuals who didn't actually live in Compton had registered to vote there. In fact, one of them, I think, had registered to vote at the house of city council member who won that race. The race was overturned, and those people all eventually, I think, pleaded guilty to election fraud. But that's the races like that. We have them all over the country all the time.
Yeah. Patterson, New Jersey, during the height of mail voting in 2020, had a local election that was so corrupted by mail ballots. Mail ballots were being shoved into people's mailboxes illegally. That whole race had to be redone.
That's right.
And this wasn't from the 50s or the 30s or Al Capone. This was within the last few years. These races, these contests have to be redone because of fraud.
Yeah. So anyone who says that we don't need to worry about this is just wrong. Now, we should say there are still problems. I mean, that's what you guys do, is try to ferret out those problems.
If you were on the other side as part of this consortium of vote fraud deniers who want to say it's not a big deal, and we know their names. We could do a whole show on the names. We won't today, but I'm tempted to book one soon. Why don't you start to at least try to sound reasonable and occasionally concede that there's problems? Like, why are they so locked in on this false narrative that this is not a concern? Is it because they're getting paid, or do they really believe it, or is it a mix of both?
Well, I think they do that because that's the standard excuse they use to oppose all reform. You know, whether it's states trying to put in ID laws, whether it's states trying to do basic things to maintain accurate voter rolls, you know, take people off who moved out of state or have died. They oppose all those reforms. They're not for any of them. I mean, it's just astonishing. And I think the reason they don't want to admit fraud happens is because they use that as their way of fighting any kind of a reform that would increase, frankly, honesty of the election.
Well, then I'll answer my own question. I'll go with it's both they're being paid and they truly believe it.
Well, I think it's a mix.
Yeah. So shifting gears, you and I have served together on many different committees and commissions in the Justice Department. But most recently, there was a meeting of the Election Assistance Commission Board of Advisors. And Many stories are going to be told from that. But the Board of Advisors is a group that is set up by Congress by statute to advise the Election Assistance Commission. And who gets to be on it is also set by statute.
Right.
I was a designee of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, for which I am also a commissioner. So we had a deal with the Democrats that we each would designate, and I was the designee.
Right.
How did you get on the Election Assistance Commission Board of Advisors?
Well, I think the Board of Advisors has about 36 members, and kind of a weird statute. You know, when Congress put the statute together, they gave all these different groups the ability to appoint somebody, like the National Association of Governors, you know, the National Association of, I think it was mayors.
Yeah,
but they also gave appointments to different committees in Congress, and the House Administration Committee. That's the committee in the House, as you well know, because both testified in front of it. That's the committee that has jurisdiction over election bills, and both the chairman of the House Administration Committee gets an appointment, and the ranking minority member gets an appointment. And in this case, the chairman appointed me to be on the Election Assistance
Commission. So when the meeting takes place once a year at the Election Assistance Commission, there's actually an election within the board, right?
Yes.
There's a president and a secretary. And I won't put you on the spot quite yet, but I was struck by how the election officials who were appointed as board kind of viewed this as it's my party kind of deal. Like this is our world, not yours. And the outgoing president and secretary, I think, were both election officials, local election officials or state. So we decided to run, right?
Yeah.
And we were sure we were going to win, weren't we?
No. I mean, it's a mixture of election officials who have been appointed as members, folks like you and me, and then some of the associations appoint who apparently really don't know anything about elections.
Like the Brennan Center. No, that's a joke. but there was actually a Brennan Center person who was a designee, I think maybe of the Conference of Mayors, but I might have that wrong.
I think that's
right.
Correct.
So this hodgepodge of about 30 people gather in this room, they hold their own election to who the president is.
Right.
You ran for president, I ran for secretary, and we lost to election officials.
That's correct.
So, look, the way that Congress has set up the EAC Board of Advisors looks to me, if you do the math, skews a little bit left. And maybe Congress needs to rethink that to make it more bipartisan.
Yeah, and I also think that they need to change some of the rules, for example, and make sure that, look, it's only got two officers. Well, if they really want this board to be bipartisan, then shouldn't there be a requirement that the two officers be from different political parties? That's right. Not currently.
One of the issues we confronted was two issues in particular. One was Commissioner Palmer's idea that he has been pushing for years to use commercial data for voter roll maintenance. HILF does that.
Right.
We use commercial data to find dead people, find duplicates, cross-state duplicates. Nobody else really does that. Don has a great idea. That's why we took it up. But also in relation to non-citizen instructions on the federal form. So states like Arizona can have a state proof of citizenship requirement, say, for elections. And the EAC has not been approving those requests, maybe for 20 years.
Right.
We offered our opinions at that meeting. We weren't quiet. I would say that you had a lot of great ideas.
And we were definitely speaking up.
Even if we lost the election, we had our voice heard.
Right.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think it was important that, and by the way, progressive members of the body that we were serving with were looking around and saying, I've never seen this many of you show up before. Did you remember that?
Yeah.
So progress is being made.
No, that's very true. Look, there's a lot of work still to be done on this, but I had a credit the Public Interest Legal Foundation with a lot of the advancement that's been done. You know, when you guys file suits against states for not cleaning up their voter rolls under the National Voter Registration Act, you are stepping in where the Justice Department refused to go. I mean, the prior administration refused to enforce any provision of federal law that required states to maintain accurate voter rolls, which was, you know, such a dereliction of their duty.
Well, we will have more on that, and we'll talk about it at Protecting Your Vote. We have just found lots of problems in another state, in a group of states, some of whom are holding big elections this year. So stay tuned for more of that on Protecting Your Vote. Thank you very much, Hans von Spakovsky, for joining us. I'm J. Christian Adams. You've been listening to Protecting Your Vote. For more information, go to publicinterestlegal.org. Thank you.